Gemara Simatova. We are between the very special days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And of course all
recording in progress.
All focus now shifts towards Yom Kippur. And I'd like to open a discussion with regards to Yom Kippur that starts with what one could call the central pasuk that we say on Yom Kippur, and that is, of course, Ki vayom hazeh yichaper lechem letaher eschem, on this day Hashem will atone for you, to purify you, mikol chatoseichem lefnei Hashem titaru. And we say this pasuk, you know, again and again. And we note that there are two ideas that are mentioned, namely kapara and tahara, that we would translate as atonement and purity. And the question, of course, that we wish to ask is, what is the difference in connotation between these two? We assume that if a person has atonement, so then they're purified. The part of being purified is getting atonement. We would see them almost as synonymous one with the other. And yet the pasuk seems to have split them up into two. And it starts, Yechaper Lechem. The day is called Yom HaKippurim, interestingly. And the pasuk says, Yechaper Lechem Ater Eschem, and ends with telling us, Lefnei Hashem Titaru. So we begin by referencing the Rambam in the beginning of Hilchos Tshuva. And here the Rambam says, we'll just read a couple of lines. Kol ha-mitzvah sheba Torah, all mitzvahs of Torah, ben aseh, ben lo taseh, whether positive or negative, im avar odom al achas mihen, if a person violated one of them, whether intentionally, unintentionally, kishiyaseh tshuva, v'yoshuv mecheto, when he does tshuva and repents or returns from his sin, chayav lehisvados, he needs to say vidui. That's how the halachos, Hilchos Tshuva begin with the requirement of saying vidui. When a person does tshuva, he needs to say vidui, and he cites a pasuk in Parshas Noso, which states, v'hisvadu eschatasam asher chatu. That's a obligation from the Torah to say vidui. Without getting too much into it, because this would become the entire discussion, there is a major question by the Mefarshim as to how the Rambam understands the mitzvah of tshuva. Is tshuva a mitzvah? If it is, what is the source in the Torah? We naturally assume that tshuva is a mitzvah. The Rambam here described tshuva as something that you do, and when you do tshuva, so then you're obligated to say vidui. So the chiyuv is actually focused on vidui, and that leads some mefarshim to conclude that tshuva itself is not a separate mitzvah in the Torah, because tshuva just basically says you have to do the right thing, which is always true, regardless of whether you've been doing the wrong thing until now. If a person has kept kosher his entire life, so then he has to keep on keeping kosher for the mitzvah of kashrus. And if he hasn't been keeping kosher yet, so now he has to start because of the mitzvah of kashrus. So one doesn't need a separate mitzvah saying, turn to do the right thing, because you always need to do the right thing, regardless of whether you have until now. That's how the Meshech Chochma and others explain that tshuva per se is not a separate mitzvah, and vidui is really the mitzvah, because that's a chiddush. One wouldn't have known that one has to say vidui and confess and so on, which is such a major part of Yom Kippur, the ten viduim. And this is underscored, this understanding, by the fact that the Rambam in the Sefer HaMitzvos cites the mitzvah of vidui, and as we saw just now, he quotes as the source the pasuk in Noso, which is the v'hisvadu eschatosam. He doesn't actually codify a mitzvah per se of doing tshuva. Having said that, it is also pointed out that in the Rambam's opening, before he even starts chapter 1, halacha 1 of any set of halachas, he tells you how many mitzvahs there are and gives you a brief one line about each mitzvah. And here, says the Rambam, there's one mitzvah in Hilchos Tshuva, mitzvah achas, one positive mitzvah, v'hi sheyashuv hachote mechet o lifnei Hashem, that the person should do tshuva, v'yisvade, and say vidui. So in this opening, its introductory line, the Rambam seems to have included tshuva within the mitzvah, and it's a composite mitzvah of doing tshuva and vidui. This is something that is discussed at length by the Mefarshim. What is the mitzvah? Is it comprised of different parts? And so on and so forth. One thing is for sure. Without vidui, the mitzvah has not been done. I mean, that it's either the mitzvah or certainly an integral part of the mitzvah. And indeed, we say vidui on Yom Kippur. And that's how we do tshuva. Alongside all the other aspects of tshuva. But vidui is indispensable. And the Rambam goes on to say, in the first halacha there, whoever ever needs to bring a korban, it doesn't work for them until they do tshuva and vidui. Rambam always emphasizes without the vidui, it's not going to work. The reason why this is so noteworthy is because there is a famous Mishnah in Maseches Kiddushin in the second perek. One wouldn't have expected such a major discussion of tshuva to take place in the halachas of Kiddushin, but that's kachi darka shel Torah. And the way that it happens is as follows. As we know, when it comes to Kiddushin, any transaction, but certainly among them Kiddushin, it's possible to perform Kiddushin al tanai, based on condition. It's not recommended, but it is possible. And then one needs to then see, was the condition fulfilled? Which means if a person betroths a woman, gives her kiddushin al menas on condition that he will do such and such, then if he does it, the kiddushin goes through. If not, then not. And sometimes there can be cases where he gives kiddushin on condition that I am such and such. What if he says on condition that I'm a chacham? So now the question is, well, define a chacham and don't ask him. And then the whole question is, what is a chacham? And so on and so forth. Within the course of this series of Mishnayos, the Mishnah says, it's in Kiddushin Daf Mem Tes Amud Beis, if a person gives money to a woman and is mekadish her, al menas that I'm a tzaddik. Do we consider the Kiddushin to be valid or not? Says the Gemara, it is. And even if we knew him to be a rasha prior to that point, which is quite a thing to say. This isn't just someone that we don't know. Even if we knew him to be a Rasha, Rasha'im are defined as they're defined. Of course, nowadays, we don't like to judge. To say that a person is a Rasha, that's it's a big Aveira to judge. So we don't like to judge, but we do it anyway. We just don't call it judging. We call it knowing, and then everything's okay. But even if he is a Rasha, one has to be concerned that the Kiddushin might still be valid, but it's conditional upon him being a tzaddik. We know he's a Rasha, says the Gemara, but maybe he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart as he was saying this. Maybe. And if that's true, then the Kiddushin will go through, and therefore one needs to be conscious of that and take it into account. It's a fascinating discussion, of course, in itself. But in terms of our broader discussion, the reason why it is so significant is because many Mefarshim ask the question, but so what? So what if he have thoughts of tshuva in his heart? That's part of it, but it's not all of it. Didn't the Rambam emphasize that tshuva, in order for it to work, one needs tshuva and vidui? We never heard any vidui. Thoughts of tshuva are the beginning of the process, but they're not the subtotal of the process. And therefore, how can we say, well, maybe he is a tzaddik, maybe he had thoughts of tshuva. Good for him that he started, but there's other things he needs to do. And how then can the Mishnah, just to put the question into one sentence, how can the Mishnah say that a person can become a tzaddik based on thoughts of tshuva alone when we happen to know that there are other integral and indispensable parts of the process? That is the question. And this question is addressed famously by the Minchas Chinuch. The Minchas Chinuch in Mitzvah Shin Samach Dalet says a fascinating thing. The truth is that when it comes to tshuva, and of course this is the mitzvah of the day, this is in Yonah D'Yoma, when it comes to tshuva, there are two things that need to be considered. There's two elements to what is happening. Number one, there is the erasure of a person's sins, which is an incredible thing. We call that kapara. We call that atonement, whereby a person has sins in his account, shall we say, or to his name, I'd say to his credit, but it's to his discredit, and they go away. And he doesn't have to suffer on their account or bear any retribution on their account. That's the aspect of kapara. That's atonement. But there is a second element, says the Minchas Chinuch, aside from whether this person is in possession of a history of wrongful deeds, an account of wrongful deeds. What is the status of the person himself? Is this person a tzaddik or a rasha? Is this person good or not good? Heading in a good path, heading in not a good path. That is the what lies at the inside of tshuva. It's not a question as to whether he will have to suffer retribution for what he's done. What type of person is he? When you talk about a rasha or a tzaddik, that's a discussion of the person himself. Not so much a question of what did he do that he will now need to answer for. Says the Minchas Chinuch, when we say that things like vidui, confession, which is has a very set aspect to it, and it's verbal and so on, when we say that vidui is indispensable to the tshuva process, that means that vidui is indispensable to a person affecting or achieving kapara for themselves, to atone for their averus and have them removed. Lechaper means for something to be removed, and a deed to be removed. For that you need vidui. And that's what the Rambam is talking about. But when the Mishnah in Kiddushin says that a person can go from being a rasha to a tzaddik just by thinking about tshuva, making an authentic and genuine decision in their heart that they wish to do tshuva, even if they haven't done vidui, they can still become a tzaddik because the person himself has changed through thereby from being a rasha to a tzaddik. Now, it is true, he is now a tzaddik with the past that he still hasn't dealt with. In other words, the ideal situation is that a person does tshuva and gets kapara. He becomes a tzaddik and all of his averus go away. In this instance, he became a tzaddik, but his averus haven't gone away. So he's a tzaddik with averus in his history. But his present, he is now a tzaddik. So he will probably yet want to follow up, I guess, at some point, either during Sheva Brachos or afterwards with vidui in order to get kapara. But a tzaddik he is. This is the fundamental discussion of the two aspects of tshuva. The tshuva itself as it defines the status of the person and the kapara. And it is pointed out by many Mefarshim in the Machon Yerushalayim edition of the Minchas Chinuch. They mention this in the notes. This very distinction and this very dissertation is to be found in Rishonim as well. In the Sefer Or Zarua, Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, from the 1200s, the Sefer Or Zarua states exactly this. A person, in order to get kapara, will need to say vidui. But if he just has tshuva thoughts, he has already become a tzaddik, says the Or Zarua, as we see very clearly from that Mishnah in Kiddushin, that if a person makes the Kiddushin conditional upon being a tzaddik, we consider maybe he is a tzaddik based on the possibility that he had tshuva thoughts in his heart. That's enough to make a tzaddik. And that is an amazing thing to know about tshuva. Coming back to our pasuk, then, Ki vayom azeh yechaper aleichem letaher eschem, and we raise the question, are these not two ways of saying the same thing? Kapara, atonement, tara, purity, isn't one just another way of saying the other? But not so. And there's many answers to this question, but Rav Osher Weiss suggests, based on the above, the Or Zeruah, and the Minchas Reinach based on the above distinction, this is what is behind the two terms of Kapara and Tahara. Kapara, as we said, is to wipe away. That is to say, it's the removal of misdeeds, of past misdeeds from a person's debt that they would need to suffer retribution for or deal with otherwise. The removal of those deeds, that's kapara. The change in the status of the person from Rasha to Tzaddik, that's Tahara. That's the Chaper Alechem L'Taher Eschem. These now become the two goals of Yom Kippur. In truth, says Rav Asher Weiss, one could say that this duality within Tshuva, as we just described it, is really also what stands behind the fact that there are two separate brachas dealing with Tshuva in the Shmona Esrei, when you think about it. In other words, as soon as we've started with Chonin Hadas, you can't do anything really without Das, then the next bracha we say is Hashiveinu Avinu L'Sor Asecha, which is about Tshuva, Harotze B'Tshuva. And then we say Slach Lanu Avinu, it's a separate bracha. If we would put everything about Tshuva together and understand that it's all one thing, so why are they split into two? But they are split into two. Because the first thing that we ask is that Hashem help us do tshuva and attain the status of tzaddikim. If that's eluding us so far, or to whatever degree we need to do tshuva, in terms of our own tahara, our own personal status. Then we move to dealing with past deeds. Regardless of whether you're a tzaddik or a rasha, if you have averos in your account, they need to be dealt with. And that's then we ask for slach lanu avinu and mechal lanu makenu, etc. So one really sees the two elements of the tshuva process here reflected in the bracha of hashiveinu and of slach lanu, respectively. Coming back to our pasuk, therefore, what will emerge is something very interesting. Hashem says He will be mechaper for us. Ki vayom hazeh yichaper aleichem. Hashem will be mechaper, or the day will be mechaper, Hashem will be mechaper. If the day is mechaper, it's because Hashem gives it kapara power. But kapara is something that a person can't be mechaper himself. Once we understand that kapara is the removal of sins from a person, from their history, so then you can't do that. You can ask Hashem to remove them. And he will. And that's why the kapara is something that Hashem does for you. Tahara is something that you need to do for yourself. As the pasuk concludes, Lifnei Hashem titaru. Before Hashem, you need to purify yourselves, because that's your decision, that's your free will to go from whatever you were to be the best that you can and to right wrongs. And so on. So at the beginning we have Yom Hazeh Yichaper Aleichem, which is something, kapara is something that Hashem does for you. The end of the pasuk, titaru. The tahara is the tshuva itself you need to do for yourself. What's interesting is in the middle. And it's such a specific phraseology, and we know the pasuk very well. The pasuk doesn't say ki vayom hazeh yichaper aleichem v'yitaher eschem. We say they're two separate things, but they're not. But they're actually connected, because the pasuk says "Bayom hazeh yichaper alechem l'taher eschem." Hashem will give you kapara in order to be metaher you. But how does the kapara that Hashem gives you lead for you to be metaher? And I believe that perhaps part of what the pasuk is saying is that, you know, if a person could only start from the beginning again, especially in light of experience and so on, why would a person not choose the right path and do? They've seen where the wrong path leads them. So the problem is the inhibition against tshuva is that we have done things in the past. And therefore, they weigh us down. And the way forward doesn't seem so clear just to kind of start again. And therefore, the greatest help that Hashem can give a person to help them in their tshuva journey, the person, only the person can be metahir themselves. That's their decision. But what can Hashem do to help them? He can be mechaper for them. He can remove their averus from them. Remove them from just that the shackles of the things that they've done. That's kapara. Kapara means it is removed. It's more than pardon and forgiveness. Pardon and forgiveness can happen and the thing is still there, as we know. Kapara means it's removed. It's been taken away. It's not there anymore. The gift of kapara is that it allows a person's history to become a thing of the past. Because history doesn't always become a thing of the past. Sometimes it stays in the present. Lahavdil, if ever there are two people and there's bad feeling between them. So sometimes we express it, we say, there's a lot of history between them. Well, if it's between them, then maybe it's not history. Maybe it's still current affairs. So for history to become a thing of the past, so that it's just not part of what a person carries with them moving forward, that's kapara. And when a person has that, there's nothing in their way anymore to stop them from being metahir themselves. And that's the gift of Yom Kippur. The gift of Yom Kippur is kapara, which allows litahir for the avoda of Yom Kippur, which is tahara. So I think these are very wonderful ideas with which to approach the day. And again, it's a pasuk that we'll be saying so many times throughout the day to understand the synergy, really, the harmony between these two ideas of kapara and tahara, what Hashem does, what we need to do, how one helps the other. And these are the words of the Mefarshim in that regard. I'd like to move from here to spend some time on a very well-known, I think much beloved practice. It's a very wonderful moment in Yom Kippur, and that is the proclamation out loud of Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso Le'olam Voed. It's amazing to be in that moment where you said Shema and then everyone out loud Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, and to try and take a look a little bit deeper as to what is behind that. There are certain things we presumably we know. It's something that the angels say, and then we're like angels on Yom Kippur. We need to prepare a little bit more foundations in order to understand exactly what that means. So to understand the significance of saying Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso on Yom Kippur out loud, why that's so significant, we first need to start with understanding why it is that we say it quietly the whole year round. And to understand the meaning of saying it quietly the whole year round, we need to see where it comes from and how that came to be. Now, there are actually two accounts related to this matter. One is in the Gemara and one is in the Medrash. And we will start with the Gemara. Part of it is well known. I don't know that the way that it leads into our discussion is as well known. But let's begin at the beginning. This is the Gemara in Maseches Psachim, Daf Nun Vav. And the Gemara discusses the famous episode or time where Yaakov is about to bless his sons just before he passes away. And he says to them, Hey Osfu, Va'agid Lachem, gather together, and I will tell you, Esa Sheikreschem Ba'achris Hayomim, I'll tell you about the future. And the way the Gemara describes it is that he wanted to tell them about the Ketz Hayamin, the end of days, the times of the Mashiach, either when it would happen or what it would be like, or to discuss that. And as the Gemara says, Bikesh Yaakov Legalos Lebanav Ketz Hayamin, he wants to talk, V'nistalka Mimenu Shechina. But the Shechina was removed. A Navi cannot access things that Shemaim do not want them to access. They cannot retrieve information that Shemaim do not want them to have, even if they're a Navi. And so he wasn't able to tell them. But Yaakov didn't know why this information was being withheld from him. And he actually became concerned that perhaps one of his sons was not on a level that this type of information could be divulged by him. And yeah, it's amazing that until this stage, there still is that concern, because the first two generations, you had this, where one of the brothers just left the picture. One or more. With Avram's children, only Yitzchak continues. Yishmael and the other brothers, Bnei Keturah, they left the picture. And so too with Yitzchak. He has two sons. Yaakov stayed in, and Esav is out. And now it's Yaakov's turn, and he has 12 sons. And he wonders, could it be that one of them has somehow lost his way and maybe is not really part of the program? When the brothers saw that this is what Yaakov is worried about, either they saw or he voiced his concern, they responded and they said, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. This is the Shema originally as recorded in the Gemara by the brothers. And they said, Shema Yisrael. And they're talking to Yisrael. They're talking to the original Yisrael. He's Yaakov. And they said, Hashem is our God. Hashem is one. As the Gemara explains, what they're saying is, we are all part of this one program, just as he's one for you. He's one for all of us. And we're all in. And at that moment, Yaakov responded by saying, he heard them say Shema, and he responded and said, Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso Le'olam Vaed. That's his response to hearing all of his sons say Shema Yisrael. Incidentally, or parenthetically, I should say, more correctly, and this I heard from my father Zatzal many years ago, some raised the question, you're not meant to call your father by his first name. Here the sons are saying Shema Yisrael. How can they call him Yisrael? That's his first name. And he cited a ritva, Maseches Yuma, Daf Lamed Ches, that Yisrael is different because it's a title that was bestowed to Yaakov by Hashem. So it's actually a title of honor, and the brothers could actually refer to their father Yaakov as Yisrael. It's an amazing situation. Either way, this is the original, the pre-version, so to speak, of the Shema. There's not yet Tariq Mitzvahs, but the brothers are intuiting the formula of Shema, and Yaakov responds by saying, Baruch Shem Kavod Machuso Le'olam Vaed. And then the Gemara moves forward in time to a quandary of the rabbis. In other words, as we then now say the mitzvah of Shema on a daily basis, it's a mitzvah from the Torah, morning and evening. How should we proceed? Should we say Baruch Shem Kavod? Should we not say it? And they were in a dilemma. And because they said, well, you know, should we institute to say Baruch Shem, like Yaakov did? But Moshe didn't say it. Now, when we say Moshe didn't say it, what that means is, this is in Chumash Devarim. Moshe is transmitting the Torah and transcribing the Torah from Hashem, and there's no Baruch Shem in the Torah. So that's what we mean when we say Moshe didn't say it. So you can't just say it because Moshe didn't say it. So then you might conclude, okay, so don't say it. But you can't not say it, because Yaakov said it. So we're stuck between this almost historical machlokas between Moshe and Yaakov. And in the end, they instituted that it should be said quietly. And that solves everything. That is the origins of saying Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso, quietly. It's somehow to find a middle ground between Yaakov's inclusion of this sentence and Moshe's omission of this sentence. And the Gemara continues, and concludes actually. The Gemara concludes with a mashal, a parable, to illustrate this idea. It's a parable of a princess, and she catches the aroma of certain food, which is like the burnt part at the bottom of the food, which has a very pungent odor, and everyone likes it, but it's not very choshev. It's not very highbrow food, not really fitting for a princess, and now she's stuck. This is the mashal. She's stuck because, you know, if she says something, so she's degrading herself, because a princess shouldn't really be eating food like that. But she wants it. So if she doesn't say anything, she'll be in distress. So what she did is she quietly asked her servants to bring her this food. That is the parable to explain why we say Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso quietly. Now, needless to say, there are a number of questions that we might wish to ask about this Gemara. Firstly, we see that we're stuck, because Yaakov said it, but Moshe didn't say it, so we're not really quite sure how to proceed. But why are we not sure how to proceed? After all, our fulfillment of the mitzvahs is as per transmitted to us by Moshe Rabbeinu. We look to the Avos for inspiration, but they're in the pre-Matan Torah era. Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. He's called Moshe Rabbeinu. They're the Avos. And therefore, why should we be torn in any way? If there's for some reason a discrepancy between them, we clearly should follow the way Moshe did it and not look back. So where does this dilemma come from? That's the first question. Secondly, if there really is a dilemma, we're not quite sure how to proceed. When was saying something quietly ever an acceptable way of satisfying both positions? In other words, at the end of the day, you're saying it. It is never the solution. We never find that it's a solution. I'm not sure whether I should say this, so I'll say it quietly. That's never been the way forward. Not if you don't know whether you should say something in your davening, or what if you're not sure whether something is Lashon Hara? Say quietly? That's not a solution. But here it is. But how is it? How is it so? And more to the point, one could say, why is there a discrepancy between Yaakov and Moshe? I mean, let us ask in the most simplistic way we can. We assume there is a right way to say the Shema. There is an optimum way to say the Shema, either with the sentence Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso or without it. Whichever one it is, why did one of them not do that? In other words, if it's better to say it with it, so why does Moshe leave it out? If it's better without it, why does Yaakov put it in? So how is there a machlokas here? And finally, how does the parable help us? I mean, the parable is almost like it's in its own world. There was a princess, and she had this food, and she's talking, and she can't say something, she can't not say something. A parable is there where we're not fully understanding the matter, and then the parable helps us give greater understanding. That's why it's called a moshel. An allegory is called a moshel. A moshel is from the word moshel, which is control. It's to give you control over the idea. In this instance, unless we understand otherwise, the moshel possibly makes the matter even more perplexing. First we had the Gemara to try and unravel, and now we have additionally a moshel to try and work out. So how does this matter open up for us? The Maharal, in the Sefer Nesivos Olam, in the Siva Avoda, Perek Zayin, explains as follows. He begins by positing the following. Every person needs to accept on a basic level Hashem as the creator of the world and their king. I mean, that's basic. And that's really what Shema represents. We are mindful, just a few days ago, the Pasuk of Shema is the final Pasuk of Malchios in Musaf. It doesn't say the word Melech, but it's got Malchus written all over it. And it's Pasuk number 10 of Malchus. That is the basic foundational acceptance of Hashem as creator and king. But then you have this sentence, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso. And that, says Maharal, he states it and doesn't so much elaborate on this, others do, Rav Hutner in the Pachat Yitzhak and others, that Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso represents a higher level of relating to Hashem as king. Perhaps one could say, perhaps on a Balabatusha level, but that Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso already not just to be recognizing Hashem as king, but to be proclaiming the glory of his kingdom, that's already a person needs to be on a higher level in order to do that. In the words of the Maharal, you need to have attained a level of kedusha in order to fully chime in with Baruch Hashem Kavod Malchuso. Now, what's an example of such a person who is fully able to say those words? Yaakov Avinu, Kadosh Yaakov. Yaakov is the choice of the Avos. He builds on the earlier achievements of the Avos, and he achieves the pinnacle of all the three. So if there's anyone who is qualified to say Baruch Hashem Kavod Malchuso as a proclamation, it's Yaakov. No question about it. Now, what about Moshe? I mean, Moshe is less eligible than Yaakov? No, of course, he's more so. But we need to remember, when we talk about Moshe missing it out, it's not Moshe's personal practice of how he says the Shema. It's Moshe writing in the Torah. Whatever is in the Torah needs to be actionable and accessible for everyone. So in other words, the mitzvah as presented in the Torah will really be pitched at the what we could call the lowest common denominator. There's no one who can't say Shema. Baruch Hashem Kavod Malchuso, it depends. And therefore Moshe leaves it out. You can't give that over to the Jewish people as something, because not all the Jewish people are like Yaakov. And that is how things lay. So now the question is, how do we proceed? How do we move forward in terms of the ongoing recitation? And the rabbis were in a quandary. On the one hand, there's no doubt in the world that you cannot say it out loud. The very reason that Moshe didn't put it in the Torah means it's not appropriate for everyone just to say this. So you can't say it out loud because Moshe didn't say it. Now you might say, so then leave it out. Moshe left it out, so we should leave it out. To which the Gemara says, yeah, but Yaakov said it. And what does that mean? But we're not Yaakov. True. It's true. We're not Yaakov. But we're not fundamentally and totally detached from Yaakov. It's not that we have nothing in common with Yaakov. We have a lot in common with Yaakov. Yaakov had a neshama Torah, so do we. In terms of that makeup, the makeup of a Jew, I mean, there's levels, but fundamentally, the makeup of the Jew is like that of Yaakov. Now, the difference between them is that for Yaakov, his soul took over and dictated the way that he went about everything in his life. It dominated his mode of living. That's why Yaakov is a Kaddush as an entity, because he allowed the Kedusha to from his neshama to spread to everything. That's why he's Yaakov Avinu. What about us? Less so. Work in progress. Not as much. So we can never delude ourselves into thinking that we are on a level equivalent to Yaakov, perhaps. But we dare not forget or lose sight of the fact that we have something in common with him. We have the same internal capacity in principle that he had. And why can we not lose sight of that? Because if you lose sight of it, then how are you ever going to get closer to him, to his level? You don't even know what capacities you have. For a person to think that their entire being is as holy as Yaakov, that's a delusion. That's a kind of a tragedy. But for a person not to realize that they don't have anything in common with Yaakov is a catastrophe. And therefore, you can't not say it. Because otherwise you're saying, Yaakov is him, I'm me, never the twain shall meet, and leave me alone. So what's the way forward? What's the resolution? The resolution, says the Gemara, is to say it quietly. How did that ever solve anything? Says Maharal, a wonderful thing. You can't say it out loud because you're not Yaakov. And you can't miss it out completely because you have something in common with Yaakov. What do you have in common with Yaakov? Your neshama. So how do you say it? You say it quietly, in an inner way. To yourself, almost. In a neshamadik way. You're giving expression to the fact that there's something within you It's said in an undertone. It's said in that type of muted way whereby this is something that exists inside. It's like an internal way. Because inside of us, that's what we have in common with Yaakov. That's what leads to saying Baruch Hashem quietly. Amazing. And this is the mashal, says Maharal, because you have the princess. And the princess, she's almost like, she can't say something and she can't not say something because it'll either be degrading or distressing. That's the matzav of the neshama, says the Maharal. A person's soul is the princess. A person's soul is bas malachim. It's from royalty. It comes from Hashem. And there's something that it wants to say. But if it says it out loud, it's degrading. Because the person degrades themselves because they're deluded to thinking they're much holier than they are. So you can't say it out loud. But you can't say nothing because it's distressing not to say that. There's an aspect of the person that needs to express this. And therefore, it's said quietly. This is the matzav the whole year round. But now we understand what changes on Yom Kippur that allows us to say this out loud. If what was stopping us saying this out loud throughout the year is because someone like Yaakov, someone whose existence, whose being is like Yaakov, can say this out loud. And we're not like that. We'd like to be closer, and we're hopefully getting closer steadily, but that's true. But it comes Yom Kippur, and every person on Yom Kippur is like Yaakov for one day a year. Of course, we're not like Yaakov because Yaakov sustained this throughout the entire year. But for that one day, we touch the Madrega of Yaakov. And this is the one time where a person can say these words out loud and it's not degrading. It's only degrading because that's for a person of Kedusha to say that sentence. Are you a person of Kedusha? Yes. Today I am. Tomorrow? Not sure. I hope so. I can't be certain. But today, 100%. It's an amazing thing. And I think one could even perhaps see the quiet Baruch Shem throughout the year as maybe something of like a muffled echo of this proclamation that we make on Yom Kippur. Should listen to it, because that's the part that reminds us what we're capable of and where we're capable of going. That's the Maharal with regards to the Gemara. There is, of course, as we know, a parallel idea, and it ends in the same zone. Of course, the full reconciliation, one would need to consult the Mefarshim, but the parallel Medrash, which I think is better known, is that Moshe, when he ascended to receive the Torah, he heard the Malachim saying, Baruch Hashem Kvod Malchuso. And he took it from them. This is the Medrash in Dvarim Rabba. He took it from them, and he brought it back to the Jewish people, but he said, you have to say it quietly. Because otherwise the Malachim, it will arouse the jealousy of the Malachim. So we say it quietly. Except in Yom Kippur, that we're like Malachim, and then we say it out loud. I think that's the better known version of why we do this out loud on Yom Kippur. And needless to say, HaMedrash HaZeh Omer Darsheni. How are we to understand this Medrash? We say it quietly because otherwise we don't want the Malachim to get jealous. Seemingly, the premise is that if you say it quietly, if you say it out loud, the Malachim get jealous. But if you say it quietly, so what? So that the Malachim won't hear? Are we to assume that Malachim cannot hear something that a person says quietly? What if they listen closely? What if they're curious? They still can't hear. Additionally, if they can read, so maybe they can't hear what you're saying, but they can look in the Siddur. Right under Shema Yisrael, they will find, albeit in smaller print, but we assume that Malachim are able to read small print, and they will find Baruch Hashem Kavod Malchuso Le'olam V'Ed. Additionally, throughout the year, we say it quietly because we don't want to arouse the jealousy of the Malachim. Okay, and therefore we assume that they just don't know that. Okay, But, you know, when Yom Kippur comes and we say it as loud as we can, that's the day where it's basically revealed that that's what we've been saying all this time. So presumably that's what we're saying quietly for the rest of the year. And moreover, and the questions will go on and on, but maybe we say Baruch Shem Kavod quietly, but the Medrash, which gives the background to us saying it quietly, spoke about it quite loudly. Does a person need to read that Medrash quietly? Because if Malachim are there when a person is learning, or they themselves are learning the Medrash, and the Medrash says it was stolen from Malachim, then the whole thing is now out in the open. And finally, this whole notion that we wish to avoid the jealousy of Malachim. Malachim are famous for not really having the trait of jealousy. They're Osei Shalom Bimromov. One of the reasons why we like to be B'Shalom and Yom Kippur is in order to be like Malachim. And here, we're worried that they'll be jealous. These are basic questions. And the answer is really as per the above. When we say that angels don't have jealousy, it means that they don't have the trait of petty jealousy for personal reasons, but they will be jealous on behalf of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Zealous, really, we would say, kina and kanaos, they'll be protective of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's honor, and so they should be, and so we should be. But Malachim, that's their job. So when they hear people saying Baruch Shem Kavod Malchusu, which is such an elevated thing, and if it's not appropriate for a lowly being to say this elevated thing, they're jealous on HaKadosh Baruch Hu's behalf. It's not correct. And they're right. But what's the solution? Once again, you say it quietly. If you say it quietly, you do not arouse the jealousy of the Malachim, not because they can't hear what you're saying, but because you've acted honestly and appropriately with this. I'm not saying it out loud. I can't, because I'm not an angel. But there's something within me that's angelic. I can say it in an inner way, and the Malach has to agree, yes. That much we concede. Correct. And then comes Yom Kippur. And in Yom Kippur, we say it out loud. And there's also no worry of arousing the jealousy of the Malachim, because in Yom Kippur, it's the one day a year where we're able to say, if the Malachim will say, only holy beings like angels can say that. Are you entitled to say that? The answer is yes. Today we are. That is what is so special about Yom Kippur. It's a day where you could answer to any angel. If you would come zealous on Hashem's behalf and say that praise is reserved for elevated beings, the answer is yes, and elevated beings are proclaiming it right now. That's us in Yom Kippur. So I think this gives us a deeper appreciation. It's a brief moment in the morning and then the evening and the morning, etc. And of course, heading into Yom Kippur, that's where we really say it, because that's where we're headed, to such an amazing day. But we hope to take the lessons or really reverberate throughout the entire year. For the final few moments, I just wanted to address something that had always, anyone who's ever reviewed or encountered the order of the Avoda of Yom Kippur must have had this question, and I was happy to see it addressed this year. In Yom Kippur, as we know, there are special Avodos that are done inside the Kodesh HaKadoshim. They are the famous Parvus Sa'ir Shiyom Kippurim, those korbanos where the blood is sprinkled, Achas Lamala, Sheva Lamata, Achas Va'achas, etc. That's done in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. And also the Keturahs. In addition to the daily Keturahs, there's another measure of Keturahs, and it's brought in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So these are really those two, the blood of the Par and Sa'ir, and the Keturahs. Now, interestingly, the first thing that is brought is the Keturahs. And the Keturahs is offered before the blood is offered. But what's most interesting is that not only does the Keturahs precede those other avodos of blood, it intercedes. By which I mean, if you've seen the Mishnayos, you see how it's described in the Chazan's repetition on Yom Kippur, the Kohen actually starts to get involved with the first of the korbanos. He shechts the par and receives the blood, and as far as we know, ready to proceed. I mean, this blood is going to be sprinkled in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. But then it's put on hold. He gives it to someone. They just need to make sure that, they'll keep stirring and it's so on and so forth. Shouldn't congeal. Because there's something else that needs to happen now. He then goes and gets Ketores, gets the coals, the Ketores, brings it into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Once he's done that, he goes back again and gets the blood from whoever was handling it and does his Achas Lamala and Sheva Lamata. It's very striking. The moral of the story is that the Ketores clearly is the first thing that's brought in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So why not deal with the Ketores first? And then when you finish that, then go to the par and do the Shechita and the whole thing. We start with the par, we interrupt to bring Ketores and then go back to the par. Very unusual. What is behind it? The Chofetz Chaim addresses why it is that the Ketores goes first. This is the Chofetz Chaim in his Sefer Shmiras Haloshan. In addition to the Sefer Chofetz Chaim, which is the halachos of Lashon Hara, which are many and detailed, there's another volume called Shmiras Haloshan, which is the Musar that accompanies Lashon Hara. And it's a volume in itself, and I think it's fair to say that of the 100% of cases of potential Lashon Hara, 95 to 99% of them will be taken care of by this Sefer Shmiras Haloshan. Because it's pretty clear that this is Lashon Hara, and after you read that Sefer, you would never want to speak Lashon Hara. The other 1 to 5% of questionable cases, okay, so now consult the Sefer Chofetz Chaim for the halachas. It's a very, very special Sefer. All of this form of the Chofetz Chaim, the way he addresses the reader, and very uplifting. And then in Chelek Beis of the Sefer Shmiras Haloshan, Chofetz Chaim says, you know why the Ketores comes first on Yom Kippur? Because Ketores is about the togetherness of the Jewish people. It has all sorts of different ingredients. And the Gemara famously says that Atanis Tzibur, if you don't have even sinners there, you kind of missed the point because everyone should be there. And the example of this, says the Gemara, is Ketores. Not all of the spices in the Ketores smell nice. The Chelbana is famous for having quite a pungent smell. And by itself, you wouldn't go near it. But when you put it in the Ketores, not only is the negative element of its pungency neutralized, but actually it can have an enhancing element for the totality. And that's the achdus of the Jewish people. We don't promote people being not tzaddikim, but the Jewish people is one whole. And that's what Ketores represents. And the word Kutra comes from the word Kesher. It's the connectedness of the Jewish people. And Ketores, famously, by the way, as per the Gemara elsewhere in Zvachim, is an atonement for Lashon Hara. And that comes first. That comes first. The connectedness of the Jewish people, the cessation from bitter comments and so on. That's the first avodah of the day. That the Jewish people sure are together. Now that they're together, all the other avodas can happen. You've got the par and the sa'ir and so on and so forth. Ketores comes first. Because without what the Ketores represents, the Jewish people are fragmented. So who's exactly getting kapara? And the korbanos or korbanos of the tzibur, there's only one sa'ir that's brought here. And there's only one, it's not each individual brings, it's one for everyone. So if everyone isn't one, you're not yet ready to have one for everyone. And that's why the Ketores comes first. Order of the day, togetherness of the Jewish people. Now we can begin. And we may add that this element is so accentuated and so highlighted by the fact that we actually come very close to bringing the blood of the par. We shech the animal. There's nothing. And then we stop. Which further emphasizes how even if you started, you just have to put it to the side. No, because you can't continue until the Ketores is offered. And it's truly an amazing perspective. And as we know, the level that we're looking to attain of closeness with Hashem on Yom Kippur, we say Avinu Shebashamayim, Avinu Malkeinu. And as the Mefarshim point out, Rabbi Yosef Nechemia Kornitzer and others, you can't really meaningfully refer to Hashem as your father without then coming to see the Jewish people as your brothers and sisters, because he's their father also. Which means to fully justify referring to Hashem as our father, it can only be when we're all brothers and sisters. That's the Ketores. And what does this mean on a practical level? No one person, I don't think, can bring the entire Jewish people together in our current experience. But practically, everyone can bring the people in their sphere a little closer together, and everyone can have with the well-being of the entire Jewish people in their heart. A Jewish heart is big enough to contain the entire Jewish people, if it opens up. And that's the way we are. And all the things that we wish, and of course, in a year such as this, it's not hard to think about other Jewish people who are in terrible situations, wherever they are, and in each one in their own way. I think it has to be the most natural Jewish feeling, if a person just is mindful of it, to have cares for the entire Jewish people in the land of Israel and in the diaspora. Each of them is worried for the other, and everyone should be concerned for everyone else. That's what it means to be a Jew. And so, as we wrote, enter the holy day of Yom Kippur, and we'll read about the Seder of Avodah, and we will read that the Avodah begins and then everything is put on hold in order for the Ketores to pave the way for any further Avodahs. But that's a message for us, for our own Kesher, which of course in principle we very much are in embrace and accept, but all the more so to enhance, and the entire Jewish people as one should emerge Mitzvah Hashem for this Yom Kippur, both with Kapara and with Tara. It should be a year for Gemar Chasivah Toba, both for the community and for all the individuals within the community. We should only hear B'suras Tovos, B'Karov, Yeshuas, B'Nechamos. All the best.